Good morning and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Just about 4 days ago, on February 4th, Alaska writer Dina Stabenow published what may be her 39th or 40th book, I'm not really sure, in her very successful career as a storyteller. Called Spoils of the Dead, it is set in an Alaska that will remind you of Kachemak Bay. It involves archaeology, murder, many suspects, but only one killer, some sexual heat for the main character, and it is absolutely ribboned with the authentic flavor of Alaska that only the homegrown can impart. This book's arrival makes a grand opportunity for a conversation with perhaps Alaska's most prolifically published writer. How did she start? Why did she continue? What has she learned along the way about the work of writing and the business of writing? And very especially, we'll learn about her mission to nurture other creatives by launching a working retreat for women writers down in Homer. It's called Story Knife Writer's Retreat, and it sits high on a bluff overlooking the bay. As always, your comments and questions are welcome throughout the program. If Dana's series heroes, Kate Shugak and Liam Campbell, have snagged your imagination, give us a call. If you got hooked by the books, which ones and why? You can join us by dialing in anytime during the show. And the number to call here in Anchorage is 550-8433. Statewide, we can take your calls at 1-888-353-5752. And I'll keep looking at our email at hometown@alaskapublic.org just in case you're shy and you just want to send your questions in by email. And I also want to say to you, go to our website, alaskapublic.org/hometown, because we have some fun stuff there about Dana Stabenow. You are going to see her give a 5-minute YouTube presentation of the Kate Shugak stories abridged. It's very fun to watch. So we've collected different things. She's got a fabulous website filled with advice for writers and readers. And so that there's an easy link there to that. So I do say don't miss it and check that out. Okay, before we get started with Dana, I'm going to just take a moment to remember Sean Lyons, who was on our show in December of 2019, and we did record a long interview with him about his love of literature, his love of music, his love of the mountains. So I just want folks to know that if they want to find that, it's easy to find on our website. Again, it's alaskapublic.org/hometown. But in this case, go to the search button and just type in Sean Lyons' name, and that interview will pop up, and also some other interviews he did with Outdoors Explorer. So he was a force in our community, and we remember him, and I think you'll enjoy listening to him again. So that's just available for you here on alaskapublic.org. All right, Dana, I'm turning to you now and saying welcome to Hometown Alaska. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you so much for having me on the show, Kathleen.
I'm thrilled to have you. I've known about you for a long time and I don't think ever really met you. I want to start with just your beginnings are so unconventional. They're so Alaskan. You know, you say you grew up on a fishing tender and you turned to writing because there had to be a drier, warmer job somewhere. But could you tell me a little bit, like, what was that like? Would you go out for, you were with your mom, right? She was working on the tender. Was she homeschooling you down in the bunks below, or what was it like?
Well, for 4 out of the 5 years, we tied up at the dock, and I went to school on shore with everybody else. But there was 1 year that we went trapping in Prince William Sound on Knight and Montague Island. And that year, she did homeschool me.
Wow. I mean, your mom sounds, is she the inspiration for any of your characters? Because she was such an independent, I don't know if your mom is still with us. Is she still here?
No.
Oh.
No, but she is absolutely the inspiration for, basically all the strong women characters.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. No kidding. Yeah. Anyway, I just thought that was amazing. And I don't know. It made you were in a way an outsider. You didn't have a conventional, in town growing up. Well, I guess a little bit when the tender was docked. But also wonder whether being out on the water, do you have an affection and affiliation for being out to sea? I see that you spent time with the Coast Guard doing research. So I'm thinking maybe life on the water does appeal to you.
Well, I never turned down a boat ride, but I have to say, Kathleen, that I'm always happy to come back to shore at the end of the day to a hot shower and a warm bed.
A very practical woman all the way around. Anyway, so, you know, as the story goes, your mom took you down to the library in Seldovia, which was like a little one room beneath the city hall or something like that, and started you out on some Nancy Drews, which hooked you. And you went through all of them in that library, but kind of dropped mysteries for a while after that. It sounds like your mom was always trying to get you to read. She loved Agatha Christie, things like that. And you wrote a really sweet essay about Josephine Tay and how she led you to a life of crime. Could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I think kids are always contrary. And because my mother read crime fiction, I decided I wasn't going to. And besides which, you know, Susan English, the librarian in Seldovia, she had plenty of other books for me to check out. So that was fine.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I think I was probably 20 when my mom finally convinced me to read The Daughter of Time by Josephine Tay. And I look back now. I just actually did a symposium, what we called a symposium, which is a discussion with authors Sujata Massey and Val McDermid and Barbara Peters of The Poison Pen on Josephine Tay.
Oh,
and
wow.
I can give you a link to that if you want. You can stick that up on the page.
Yes,
as well.
I'd love to, because I think people might want to read this book after hearing how significant it was for you.
Well, what I realized, I mean, the book is, it's a mystery, but it breaks every single convention in crime fiction, in the crime fiction genre. I mean, the detective is literally incapacitated. He's flat on his back. He literally unable to, you know, sit upright. And he solves a mystery that's 400 years old. Naturally, there is no surviving forensic evidence. The chroniclers of the time, of course, were in the pay of the king, or in patronage of the king anyway, and they're going to write what he said was okay.
Right.
And it just, it's just, he has to have a sidekick that goes out and looks up all the stuff for him. And it breaks every convention that there is. And then when I read more Josephine Tay, when I read more crime fiction and was able to compare it to what Josephine Tay writes, I realized just how unconventional she was as a writer. I just made my book club last month read Josephine Tay's The Franchise Affair, which is how two women's reputation is utterly and completely ruined by an unscrupulous individual that manages to convince everyone she's telling the truth, at least for a while. And it is so resonant of what's happening on social media today. You can draw so many parallels.
Wow.
This woman is, in my opinion, immortal. And or at least ought to be. Everybody should read her. She had a real effect on what I read going forward.
Yeah. Do you think that that's true of others? Like you said, you just did the symposium, and I'd love to have the link if you can send it. I'll add it to our webpage.
No problem.
I've got the little essay that you wrote about her and how significant and how excellent the book is. And again, for our listeners, it's called The Daughter of Time, and it's Frances. Let's see, Tay. Is that right?
Josephine Tay.
I'm sorry, Josephine Tay, The Daughter of Time. And then
had three names. Actually had three names. She was Elizabeth McIntosh when she was taking care of her father in Edinburgh. She was Gordon Daviot when she was writing plays in London, and her very first play was Richard of Bordeaux, and it was the breakthrough performance for John Gielgud. Let me just drop names all over the place here.
Oh, yeah.
And then wrote crime fiction under the name of Josephine Tay.
How is it that we don't know that? I mean, gosh, that's what do you think?
She died, I think, the year I was born, 1952.
Okay.
So, and she didn't, and, you know, she was so multifaceted a personality, and her talents lay in so many different directions that, you know, she didn't have to write crime fiction for a living, so she could write what books she wanted to. And there are many common threads that run through all the books, and one of them is reputation, which is also touched on in The Daughter of Time.
Oh.
So she could basically pick and choose, you know, what she wanted to write. And then, you know, she wrote what she wanted to write, which I think was like about seven books at most, I think. And then, you know, didn't live to write anymore.
Boy, anyway, I think people will dig out that book, The Daughters of Time by Josephine Tay. So anyway, you there you were in the soup of crime fiction and reading some of the best. I'm not sure quite where this was in your timeline, but you ended up going to UAF and getting a journalism degree. And of course, as a journalist, I'm like, well, what were you thinking? I read that.
Go ahead.
Want to be poor for the rest of your life, right? No.
My teachers pushed me toward journalism because I had a talent for writing and in Philadelphia High School, and they were good teachers too. But it never occurred to any of us, me included, that I could write fiction and make a living at it. They pushed me towards journalism. And that's why I wound up majoring in journalism for my undergraduate degree in Fairbanks.
Ah, that reminds me of, I had a high school teacher who wrote on one of my essays, "You could do something with writing." Unlike you, I thought, well, what jobs can you get? You know, I needed to plug into something that was more conventional, but I applaud you for thinking, oh, I can write books. That's just fantastic. One of the things I read about you is like, you didn't really like or couldn't or didn't like or something, the hard questions of journalism. Was that significant for you? Because you seem a brave person to me, like you'd ask anything that was on your mind. But
When I graduated from in 73, I graduated from the University of Alaska Fairbanks in 73. And at that, you know, if you cast your mind back to that time, that was when the pipeline was going gangbusters. And that's when everybody came out from outside. And there was, you know, I mean, there was literally no place to live. You couldn't afford it. And the only job that I could find as a journalist coming out of college was as a copy editor for the Anchorage Times that only paid $800 a month. Mm-hmm. You could not live on that in Anchorage in that time. You just couldn't. So I looked around, you know, and I decided eventually I wound up going to work for Alyeska, and after that, BP on the North Slope, because that's what there was. And also, let's be honest, that's
the
where
pay
the story
scale.
Was.
Yeah.
That's
yes.
That's what the story was, and I wanted to go see what was going on with my own eyes.
Right. And it was a good paying job. And were you 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off or something like that?
I was with Alyeska. I was doing the usual 9 and 2, but that was only for 4 months. And then after that, I went to work for BP. And I think I was always a week and a week.
Week and a week. Okay.
Yeah.
So, I read that you enjoyed your time off going to Hawaii and things like that. But eventually, you got a little more serious about the writing business. And almost, 12 years later, you sign up for the UAA Creative Writing Master's Program. What was that like? Was that a good experience for you?
It was. I needed two things. I needed to be reminded that I could write. I also needed to be reminded of how to write on deadline, which you have to do when you're turning in papers. And I needed to be reminded how to research.
Mm-hmm.
And the program did all of that. The program, you know, totally. And I had to read a lot of fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Like Tom Sexton's modern fiction class, you know. So I had to read a ton of other people's work. And, you know, that's what you have to do if you want to write fiction. You got to read other people's work to see how it's done.
Yeah. And so I'm sure you're aware of the financial issues at the University of State generated or originated problems that are now spilling over to the university quite a bit. And so the MFA program is on the way out, as far as I understand it. Do you have any reaction to that?
Oh, I have plenty of reaction to that.
Mm.
First, let me say, I hope there's not too much self-aggrandizement going on here, but first let me say flatly, I personally, Dana Snabenow, am an economic engine for the state of Alaska. I am a writer. I write books set in the state of Alaska, and people read them and they come up here because they read them. I just had an email today, this morning, before I got on the phone with you, from a fan who said, "Wow, you know, as soon as COVID is over, I just read this book, and as soon as COVID is over, I'm coming up to visit."
Mm.
I've had hundreds, if not thousands, of comments like that. Kathleen, people come to Alaska and they spend money there. They go to businesses there. They stay in hotels there and B&Bs, and they eat in restaurants there, and they buy stuff there. And I mean, I would assume that the state would like that,
mm-hmm.
but evidently they don't. And also, you know, multiply me by hundreds. I'm not the only writer who is writing, living in, and writing about Alaska and bringing people to the state. If it's true for me, it's true for Nick Jans. It's true for, you know, Sherry Simpson. It's true for anybody else, any other writer, John Straley for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, come on.
It's ludicrous.
It is ludicrous to end this program. What they're basically saying is, well, we don't need any more of you people. So, yeah, I don't feel strongly about this at all.
No. I could hardly tell. Let me let our listeners know our number just in case. And if you've just joined us, that was Dana Stabenow, who is just published the fifth in a series on the Liam Campbell series, and so that's the excuse for having her on, and we're going to talk about that, but we'll also talk about her current work and all that. So if you want to talk to Dana, give us a call at 550-8433, and I'm watching the email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So anyway, not a woman of faint opinion, right? By the way, one of the things I found was about you just before we jump into your writing. The worst job you ever had. This is maybe why you got your master's. Yeah, you were sorting salmon roe. This was, again, something you were, a Q&A you were giving with one of your publishers. But, you know, you say your hands and feet, so you're sorting salmon roe, and you say your hands and feet froze from the cold water used to wash the roe, and your back ached from stooping over the belt, and your shift lasted as long as the tenders were delivering salmon from the Upper Cook Inlet set net sites, anywhere from 4 to 20 hours. Salary was minimum wage. I prefer writing books.
Me too.
Yeah.
And I just point out that minimum wage at that time was $2.82 an hour.
Oh my gosh. So, you know, you've had that full Alaska experience. You've got both the fishing industry and the North Slope, oil exploration and all of that. And, I'm just trying to think, what else do I want to cover in this section?
Well, I can talk about, you know, like the best job I ever had. You just mentioned the worst job I ever had. I can tell you the best job I ever had was writing the Alaska Traveler column for Alaska Magazine.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You did that for, are you still doing that? I'm not sure.
No, I did it for 5 years, and then press of business caused me to stop. My editor was Andy Hall, who's written his own book about his dad, which everybody should go buy and read, too.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'm not sure that they're all going to want to. I'm not sure they're all going to want to climb Denali after they read that book.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, so he told me after the fact, he said he was real hesitant when he called to offer me the job. And he said, you know, he told me later, he said, nobody thought you'd say yes. And I'm thinking to myself, you're paying me to fly around Alaska and write about it. Are you kidding me?
Don't you think
I'm
smart?
No one in their right mind would say no to that.
Exactly. So, you know, did you go places you'd never, like,
oh, yeah.
Tell me a few of the things that you did that you just really, really loved getting to do.
Oh, God. Well, I got to go. I got friends in Kotzebue invited me to come and spend the July 4th weekend there. And I hired a pilot to fly me out to the Kobuk Sand Dunes, which was a place I was always going to go with my dad, who was a bush pilot, but we didn't make it before
mm-hmm.
he died.
Mm-hmm.
I did my first ride along with the Coast Guard with them. I hiked the Chilkoot Trail, God help me.
And live to tell about it.
Yeah. And what else? I went to the Kodiak King Crab Festival. Who wouldn't?
Who wouldn't? I haven't been yet. I got to go. Yeah.
You totally have to go. For one thing, you get to eat king crab. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
But probably one of my favorite things that I did was one of the easiest things I did. I drove up to Talkeetna, and I took Alaska Railroad's Hurricane Kern, which is a single car. They call it the Bud Car. And it's a single car that goes up and goes up as far as the Hurricane Turn Bridge and then turns around and comes back. And it's a whistle stop tour. So, you know, people flag it down. Homesteaders, people, trappers, hunters, fishermen, they'll flag it down as you're going up and coming back. And so there's all these great people getting on and getting off the car while you're riding along.
Mm.
And some of them would talk to me and some of them wouldn't.
That's great. Well, that was just fantastic. You know, I also read that when you got out of grad school, so now you've got your master's in creative writing, and you've relearned how to research and relearned how to meet a deadline and all that, that your goal was just to do one book, if you could just do one book. And you weren't publish a book. And that you took your North Slope savings and you set about doing it. And here, this is a series that I hadn't heard much about, the Star Sven's Daughter series. Am I saying that right, Dana?
Yeah, you are.
And so the first book was Second Star in 1991, and you sold that to some like Ace or something. But how did you get past that first book? And I think there's a story here. You had a good friend who said, hey, here's a writer's retreat. You should go. And you were like, why would they let me into that?
The friend, Kathy Kianse at that time, you'll know her more as Catherine Gottlieb, said she's the one who saw the story about Hedgebrook Writer's Retreat, which is a retreat for women writers on Whidbey Island in Puget Sound. And I'd seen it, too, and I just dismissed it because I thought there's no way they're ever going to take me. Well, Kathy called me, and she said, did you see that story? And I said, yeah. And she said, you need to apply. And I said, they'll never take me, Kathy. Come on. And she wouldn't give up. She called me literally every day, nagging me. That is exactly the right word, even though she will protest it. And finally, I think after about 5 days of it, I picked up the phone, and it was her, and she was on again. And I said, all right, I'll apply if you'll stop nagging me.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Click. So I applied, and miraculously, they accepted me.
Yeah.
And I flew down to Seattle and took the shuttle up to Mukilteo Ferry, and went over and spent 2 weeks in my very own cottage there at Hedgebrook Farm. And there's a main house and there's six cabins. We actually watched the sixth cabin being built as we were there. Me and the writers who were there with me. And all you did was you stayed in your cottage all day and you worked and they delivered lunch to your doorstep. And then you and the rest of the writers would go down to the main house and you would have dinner together. So you could talk shop and you could tell war stories and you could learn from, you know, these people who were ahead of and behind you and at the same level you were. And it was all cross-genre. There was me. I was writing popular fiction or trying to. There was a poet. There was a woman who wrote, a Latina who wrote magic realism. And, and then there was Susan, who was so intimidating because she'd written something like 30 chapter books and been published. And so they all had varying degrees of experience, just like me, and were writing in different fields of writing, but were all, you know, doing the same thing that we were all doing, which was trying to write and be heard. I came away from that experience when I left Hedgebrook Farm, Kathleen, I knew I was going to be published. Mm. There was just no way it was not going to happen after that.
Wow.
I think I came home in October 1989, and in January or February, I think, 1991, the editor called and said they wanted to buy Second Star.
And there it was. You did. Listen, Dana, we're going to take a tiny break, but we're going to be right back. We'll talk a little bit in the next section about kind of the wisdom you've gotten all these years as a writer, the slings and the arrows and the good things. And in the third segment, we're going to talk about Story Knife, which sounds a little bit like Hedgebrook. So you're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. For more information about this episode, visit us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and we're talking with Dana Stabenow today. She has a new book out in her Liam Campbell series, but actually we're going to talk about what she's actually writing this moment. Apparently she broke away from her writing desk to come to the phone and talk to us. So first let me throw out our phone numbers. If anybody wants to call us, 550-8433, or post your questions to hometown@alaskapublic.org. So welcome back, Dana, and let's talk about what you're doing right now. I guess we interrupted your creative process this morning. Go ahead.
Anything for you, Kathleen.
Yes, that's right. In Hometown Alaska.
I'm best known, of course, for the K2X series, and I've just published the fifth Liam Campbell novel. But a couple of years ago, it's been a long process, and I won't take you all the way through. I've always been interested in the story of Cleopatra. I always figured she got short shrift from the chroniclers of the time, which were all, you know, patronized by Octavian, who had a vested interest in making sure that she was demonized.
Mm-hmm.
In a much longer story than it would take time to tell on the radio, I became really, really interested in her character and in her history. And so I was reading a lot about her. And then Stacey Schiff published her biography of Cleopatra. I made my book club read it. And I thought, okay, now is the time.
Mm.
So I started writing a crime fiction series set in Alexandria in the time of Cleopatra. And it features the Eye of Isis, who is basically Cleopatra's private investigator. And the fiction I have created is that, in fact, all of the Ptolemies had their own eyes of Isis going back. And the first book is called Death of an Eye, and it came out, I think, year before last. And right now I'm working on the second book in the series called Disappearance of a Scribe. And it was inspired by Karl Marx, a name you'll know.
Yes.
Because he's the guy who first told me about Podzolan. So this is going to be a construction murder, a murder set in the construction industry in Alexandria at that time. Because this is just after the Alexandrian War that off and on lasted for 2 to 4 years, depending on which historian you read. And there was a lot of damage. And there is mention somewhere in some research that I've done that one of Cleopatra's names was Cleopatra the Builder. So she was building, rebuild the pharaoh, the lighthouse. She had to rebuild the Hepstadion, which is the bridge that connected to the Isle of Pharos. I mean, there was wreckage all over the place, and she was building it back up. So, you know, we all know how tough the construction trades are. So why not a murder set in a construction zone?
Oh, my God. But I mean, the modern day construction versus, you know, construction back then, really different. I mean, were people pulling bricks in, you know, stones into place? I mean, what kind of technology did they have?
Well, it's really astonishing to read up on technology in Alexandria at that time. Alexandria at that time, because of the library and the museum that was underwritten by the Ptolemies, the kings of Alexandria in Egypt. But they invited scholars from all over the known world to come and study and to teach at the library there in Alexandria, and they paid for their board and room. So you could come and you could live for free, and you could study and learn everything you wanted to do about your chosen, you know, discipline, and teach about it. So so if you're talking cutting edge technology in the classical world, that was the place to go. That and it had been that way for almost 300 years, and it would continue for another 400 plus years until the earthquake that sunk the most of Alexandria beneath the water.
Oh my God, I can't imagine the shift from, you know, bush pilots and fishing vessels and you know, and it also makes me think that Josephine Tay is influencing you here. You know, you're going back into history and telling a story, a woman's story of another time, and I don't know. Does it set the bar higher to go back into history? Is it harder?
I don't know. I'm used to it. Uh-huh. No, I mean, that's it certainly requires a lot of research. And I mean, if we weren't on the radio, I'd pan the camera around and show you all the research books on my in my shelves.
Yeah. Yeah.
What interested me the most when I first came to really decide, okay, I was going to write these novels, and I was doing the research, and I thought, there are an awful lot of parallels between that time and this. A lot that I can, it's almost like writing science fiction. You know, they say that science fiction is really just a mirror of what we're living through in the present day.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that, you know, people put it in a fantasy or a science fiction setting so as to not piss people off.
Mm-hmm.
And I regard writing this series set in Alexandria in the time of Cleopatra as being exactly that, being able to show us ourselves 2,000 years in the past, but there will be those echoes with the future in the present. Excuse me, the present.
Mm-hmm. Right. It will feel familiar in an odd way.
Very. It will feel very familiar.
In an uncomfortable way, maybe.
And sometimes in an uncomfortable way, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's amazing. I read a couple places about, you know, you're asked, well, where do your ideas come from? And in one place, you answered, from the idea fairy. But in another place, you said, you know, I start with the setting, and then I see what kind of trouble people can get into, something like that. Which of those is really, or are they both true?
They're both true. You know, I also say, you know, as long as people keep misbehaving on the front page of the Anchorage Daily News, I'm in business. Yeah. I mean, that's true, too.
Yeah.
Writers are thieves, not to put too fine a point on it. We listen to the stories that people tell. We read them. We research them. You know, we go out seeking them. We cultivate acquaintances with people who can tell good stories. I mean, I come by my storytelling abilities, such as they are, pretty honestly. My father was the best storyteller I ever knew.
Mm.
And Kathleen, he never once told the same story the same way in a row.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. 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 You know, I always thought sort of that you were the daughter of a single parent, and I didn't know that your dad figured so big in your life, and it's a thrill to hear it.
Well, I didn't meet him until I was 14. They divorced when I was 6 months old, and my mom moved down to Cordova, and he stayed in Anchorage, and then we moved to Seldovia, and then I had to go to Anchorage to go to the dentist, and he met me at the airport.
Ah, okay. And you really connected in a big way.
Yeah. Yep. He was such a larger than life character. No young girl who had not grown up with a father and always wondered, could possibly, you know, not fall head over heels in love with a guy.
Yeah.
Just impossible.
Yeah.
And there were plenty of women who fell in love with him too. Believe me.
Right. I get it. It reminds me a little bit of Michael Carey's father, Fabian, who was a trapper out of Fairbanks. And just, again, that bigger than life kind of character mm-hmm. from Alaska's past. So let me think. Do you want to say anything else about the disappearance of Scribe before we move on?
I'm sending it in on March 1st, and it'll be published in December of this year.
Wow.
And then I go on to write the third in the series, which is called Theft of an Idol, which doesn't mean what you think it means.
Okay. You know, one of my questions is, you're dancing between these different series, right? I mean, I don't know is Kate Chugach done now? Is that series done? But Liam Campbell
no,
is still ongoing?
I have the luxury of being able to pick and choose a little bit what I write next. And I don't think Kate is done. I don't feel like her story is completely done. I think there's at least a couple more books, but
mm-hmm.
I don't know when I'm going to write her next. If I'm going to write her after Theft of an Idol or if I'm going to return to Liam, I'm not sure. It's lovely as a writer to have those options. And I am, may I say, just luxuriating in the fact that I have them.
Yeah. But switching back and forth, is that hard? Like, you know, you're
it's actually a relief. It's actually, you know, it's a relief. I mean, I'm done with that time period for now. Let's set it aside and go back over here and see what these characters are doing.
Mm.
I think it helps.
Mm.
I think you write these books differently. You write in the different times differently. I'm not being very articulate about this, but it's true.
Well, I mean, you submerge yourself, it sounds like, and, you know, I mean, do pieces of different series creep in or are you
well,
just?
I mean, just in the dialogue and the dialogue alone, I noticed myself doing this. And when I'm writing the Kate Chugach series or writing the Liam Campbell series, I'm writing very much in the today, in the now, in the vernacular, using all the usual slang. And I've noticed that when I'm writing in the Alexandria series, the Eye of Isis series, that I'm writing a little more formally. That it's, you know, there are not quite as many contractions, and people are more respecting of boundaries, it seems like, than in the present day.
Mm.
And, I mean, you know, there's the fact that they're living in a monarchy, an absolute monarchy, that is very fragile because it's perched on, you know, the blade of Rome, the Senate and people of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
So so it's, I mean, it's just, it's, I, there's a gear that shifts, you know, from one time period to the other inside my head when I start writing.
You know, how do you immerse yourself? Say you're shifting away from Kate or Liam and you're now going to be with Cleopatra for the next, you know, 6 months or 8 months or whatever it's going to take. How do you submerge yourself back in?
I'll probably go back and skim through the first books in the series. This is what I do with any series. I'll go back and I'll just skim through. I don't read every page or every word, but I will just skim through. And since I've got a set of what I would call my working copies of all my books on my shelves, and those are the ones that are, you know, they're dog-eared and underlined and highlighted, and they have marginal locations scrawled all over them. And so I'll go back and I'll read through that, and that will get me in that time and place. And then I will go forward. But the first thing I have to do is find a, I have to find a plot to hang the, that has to be the skeleton that the story hangs on. If I don't have that plot for that set of characters, then I can't write that, I can't write that book yet. I gotta wait.
You know, I saw on your, in your acknowledgments, you said, is it, because I was going to ask you about, you know, that's daunting, diving in and getting about the business of reemerging yourself and then picking up that plot and figuring out how people are going to get in trouble and what they're going to do. And I wanted to ask you about procrastination, which is the terror of all writers. And I saw in your acknowledgement, you said the title of my next, this is the acknowledgements for Spoils of the Dead. So the most recent Liam Campbell, you said the title of my next work is going to be Love and Not Writing in the Time of COVID-19. So what was going on there?
Well, I mean, I thought to, I don't know what I was thinking, but I, when going into this, when we were all hunkered down, I thought to myself, and I said to friends too, I said, and another friend said the same thing to me. Oh, well, this is a pandemic made for us. You know, we live at home. We work alone. You know, we work alone. We're, you know, we're totally self-sufficient. And that's a bunch of baloney, let me tell you. I need people, it turns out, just as much as anybody else does. It was difficult to write this book. I had to extrude it one word at a time, and I was 2 months late with it. I'm not proud to say.
Right. Well, I mean, you do seem almost, you know, like there's nothing that can deter you from proceeding. I mean, you just have that kind of energy. You have that kind of curiosity. It's just bubbling out of you. And so it's just hard for me to imagine that you couldn't somehow... You took a nosedive.
I can only compare it to one other case, one other time in my life, and that was after 9/11. And I'm not the only writer who feels this way, believe me. We all had our 9/11 books, and I have a feeling we're all going to have our COVID-19 books.
Ah, interesting. Yeah, yeah. In other words, they were a struggle. Maybe you were
always.
You were not getting fed the ways you normally are with your social connections that everybody went through. I wonder.
Well, and the news. The news was just so horrific everywhere you looked.
Yeah.
It was just the news everywhere you looked after 9/11 and all during last year. I mean, 2020 was a year from hell. God.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know,
kidding.
It was, yeah, and it's not going away anytime soon. It doesn't seem to me either.
You feel
at least
more.
We have the vaccine now.
Yeah, right. You feel more adjusted now. Do you feel like you've got the harness back on and you know that you can keep going?
There's a place, I always say this, there's always a place in a book where you get to the top of the mountain and all is revealed to you. You know, it doesn't matter how detailed the outline you write. There are things that the characters will get up to off screen that you don't know about until you start writing the book. And I have reached that point in this book, the book that I'm working on now, Disappearance of a Scribe, the second Eye of Isis novel, where I'm at the pinnacle. I can see everything laid out before me. And just this morning, I was going into the back and into the first part of the book and filling in spaces with details that will help drive the plot along, that now that I see what the ending of the plot is.
I see, so foreshadow and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Teasing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh. Generally, that stuff is there. But I think all writers would say the same thing, that you create these opportunities for you to go back and fill in when you're writing the book. You just don't know it at the time. I don't mean to sound fey or anything. It's work, like, you know, you're digging a ditch. It's putting your butt in the seat of the chair and putting your fingers on the keyboard and just powering forward. But there are revelatory moments, and I welcome them when they come.
Yeah, yeah. I know I've heard you say that in various, you know, you've been a guest writer at 49 Writers. You've done a lot of things. And a lot of times what you're saying is write every day, you know, even if it's a paragraph, you know, move the book forward, you know, get yourself to sit down and do it. Now, we're going to take another little break right now. But when we come back, I want to ask you just a little bit about changes in the business, because they're big. And then we're going to dive into Story Knife and learn of its origins and its mission and its aspirations. So we'll be right back. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. You can find Hometown Alaska on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, here with Dana Stabenow. And we are talking about her writing career. And I'm going to give you the number one more time, but I think people are just listening to Dana. And but it, we can take your calls if you have questions, 550-8433, and email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So a tiny question for you before we dive into Story Knife, Dana. The business of publishing has changed during your career, and two things that popped up when I was just reading about you were the issue of publicity and, you know, the way publishers look at it and often, you know, are putting all their eggs in one big bestseller basket, and there's not much left over for other writers. So, you know, how have you tackled that? And the second thing is the emergence of ebooks, the going away of the printed page. So, let's just talk just a little bit about what impressed me when I read about you and your approach to the publicity issue is you just powered into it, both before digital was the world. You know, you talked about coming back across the country and stopping in all these places at Rotary clubs and bookstores and, you know, anybody that would have you to talk about your most recent book. And you upped, you know, by the time you got back to Alaska, you had the publisher had decided to increase the printing because I guess there was more demand for your book. So you personally got involved. Fast forward a little bit to a time when more things are done digitally. And what struck me is, you know, we're back on a Kate Chugach series where you did the abridged video of Kate, which is just so much fun. You created some chapters of your next book and put them on your blog. You know, you just did all this engagement. So, you know, is that a burden or do you kind of enjoy that aspect of it? It's kind of entrepreneurial. Tell me about that part of being a writer.
Well, let me give you a little perspective. Back when I was first trying to get into this business, there were 32 publishers in New York. Now there are 4, and there are about to be 3 if the Random House, or is it Penguin, whoever it is that Simon & Schuster is going to be merging with or bought by. And so there is a lot less choice in New York, in traditional New York publishing contracts, which is the holy grail for a lot of writers. There are a lot of smaller publishers around the country now. And I mean, as a result, I think, you know, but they don't have anywhere the budgets that the big publishers have. And so when I, as far as publishing is concerned, we have a lot to thank Mark Zuckerberg for. I know it's not fashionable to be happy with him, but mm-hmm. Facebook really helps. Mm-hmm. So does. I mean, I've been collecting names for people to, you know, to sign. I've been encouraging people to sign up to my newsletter for, oh, Lord, it's over 20 years now, I think. And the thing is that traditional publishing never, ever spoke to, if I may phrase it this way, their end user, i.e. the readers who wrote their books. They left all of that up to, they would do publicity when the book came online, but they didn't sell direct. They didn't form a direct relationship with the people they wanted to buy their product. Mm. And so they left this big gaping hole that writers, if they want to become independently published, they can form that relationship directly with their readers. and then form a relationship with bookstores who will distribute the books, get the books into the hands of the readers. It's a lot of work. It's not something I recommend every writer do, but that option is always available for everyone. And there's pretty much, you know, everything that you could possibly hope for in getting the news out there is available for free at your fingertips, you know. I really got fed up with the blockbuster method of New York publishing. I got really tired of that. And I thought, you know, maybe I can do this on my own, maybe I can't. But I also had an ace in the hole in the form of a guy named Scott Gere. I met him through Lynn, I can't remember her last name, the lady who owned the Book Cache. Do you remember
her?
Yeah. He's her nephew, and so she put me in touch with him, and he he's a website developer, and so he did my website. And so we formed this really strong, it's the longest, best business relationship I have ever had, and he's a really talented, smart guy. And so I had been talking to him about this, and he said, look, he said, you do the grunt work. He said, I'll do the grunt work. You write the books, I'll do the grunt work, he said.
Getting it up on the web.
Let's try this thing.
Yeah.
So, and I was terrified, and so was he, because neither one of us knew what we were doing. But we just, you know, forged ahead.
It turned out
to be very successful.
Well, I want to save time for Story Knife, so I'm just going to say that we have a link to one of your blog posts that's called Going Independent, and it has a lot of, I think maybe Scott's mentioned in there.
He is.
And you know, sort of talks about what the writer can make if she puts her work up herself versus how much she has to share if she goes through a public. You know, there's just a lot of nuts and bolts there. So definitely look that up at alaskapublic.org, and there's a link right to that. It's called Going Independent. I think for anybody who's trying to get books out there, that would be really useful. But Dana, I want to switch to Story Knife. We've got, about 10 or 11 minutes left. But the first thing, you know, we have on alaskapublic.org a video that you have been shooting all kinds of videos down there, and they've been put together in a little sort of construction, you know, watch it come together. So this is a real physical place. I think there's six cabins in a main room. And the thing that I picked up from the videos was, you know, this is for the Writer's Retreat. It's called Story Knife Writer's Retreat. It's in Homer, Alaska. I said to myself, it's like a village put this women's writing retreat together. Can you tell us where the idea came from? Where did the money come from? Where's the sustainability coming from?
The idea came, of course, from Hedgebrook, which I had mentioned before earlier on the show. It's the only, until that time, only Writer's Retreat specifically for women writers in the world, on the planet.
Wow.
So
didn't know that.
Like, you know, there are tons of writer's retreats, but they're generally all of them mixed gender. And there have been other writer's retreats for women, as I understand it, but they have not succeeded. So then Hedgebrook invited me down for their 25th anniversary, at which time they told me they could have as many as 1,400 applications for 40 spaces in a six-month semester. And I thought, that's not enough. And I had already had the idea of, because I had acquired some land in Homer, I already had the idea of doing a writer's retreat, but I didn't really have the impetus to do it. But I came home and, you know, energized. I mean, it just seemed to me wrong that there were only six cabins available for all the women writers in the world to go and have that tremendous experience, that formative experience that I had at Hedgebrook. So, and then, very fortuitously at that time, I got a phone call from a woman named Erin Hollowell, who at that time was running the Friends of the Library at the Homer Public Library. And she said, come meet me for coffee at Two Sisters. So I met her, and she'd heard about Story Knife, and she wanted to talk about it. And, oh, my God, you know, by the time I got done talking to her, I had, like, notes on napkins and things, and I thought to myself, this, I got it. I got the person I need to make this go. And so I said, okay, we're going to do this thing. I mean, there's a lot more to it than that. But I thought, okay, now we go. And so we started a capital construction campaign is what you call it. And I've already done the budget. You know, I already had a builder, and we'd come up with a budget, and we had architectural drawings and everything. And so then we just went looking for money. And Rasmussen really came out in support of us, and so did the Murdoch Trust. And then we had just, I mean, our very first big donor, get this, Arliss Sturgiluski.
Really?
Sponsored, yep. She sponsored the first cabin. We're gonna, it's named Carol, after Carol Sturgiluski, her daughter-in-law.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then Kathy Rasmussen sponsored a cabin for Diana Tillion. Jeannie Penny sponsored a cabin for her mom, Betty. The Atwood Foundation sponsored a cabin for Evangeline Atwood.
Uh-huh.
Aaron put together fundraising thing to name a cabin after Peggy.
Shoemaker?
Peggy. Yes, thank
Shoemaker,
you.
Yeah. Fairbanks.
There. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Peggy Shoemaker, who she's been such a friend of Story Knife, I can't even begin to tell you. And then, of course, Catherine Gottlieb and Cara Mars came together with the Old Harbor Native Corporation and the South Central Foundation to sponsor the last cabin for Katie Kashevirov, who is an Alaska Native elder from Seldovia.
Wow.
So we have just had, and then, oh, God, I can't forget to mention Deb McNeil, who is the founder and president of the Plum Loveland Square Foundation. They are also big supporters of us. And then, you know, we've had, as far as sustainability is concerned, we are working very, very hard at finding different, new and different ways to fund things, because as you and I know, COVID has markedly changed fundraising among nonprofits. It's going to be very difficult to fundraise going forward. So we're actively searching for new and different ways to raise funds.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're going to be relying on our friends as well who write checks, but we're just going to find other ways to raise funds as well.
Right. And, you know, I was surprised to find out, because I'm looking at all these construction videos, so I'm thinking, you're just beginning, but then I see that you have alumni dating back to 2016. So you got this going a while ago, right?
Well, I have built a guest cabin. We turned that into, I named it Frederica, after Frederica de Laguna.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ran it for 3 summers, and we had one rider at a time, which is only half the experience, because the second half, and I would argue even more important half of the experience, is the gathering together of the riders over the dinner table to form that community, to exchange ideas and information and help each other and, you know, hopefully sustain that community down through the years. I am still in contact with the riders I was with at Hedgebrook. To this day.
Yeah.
And that was in 1989.
Yeah. That's amazing.
And Aaron has created a Facebook page for the alumna of Story Knife to hang out on, so that they can all talk to each other. The ones who have been there can talk to the ones that are coming and give them advice and tell them what to look out for.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, so.
Yeah. I see that you, I believe that you, because of COVID, you weren't able to have your class of 2020. Is that right? Did you just?
No.
We're held off. But now let's look to 2021. What I see that you have an application on your website and things like that.
We would normally have started in April, but the board met in December, and Erin gave us the information that she had and her recommendation, and we agreed to it, and that was that I just don't have the guts to go and ask people for money for something that we're not even doing. So we have to have riders in cabins this year, and we want to have riders in cabins this year. That's what we're for.
Yeah.
So we decided, okay, you know, erring on the side of caution, what we're going to do here is not open in April, but open in June, June 1st.
Ah.
So our first riders will be in the cabins on June 1st of this year.
Okay. So, and you'll have one for each cabin. So we're talking 6 riders, I think.
Yep.
And I see that you have a chef on staff who will provide.
Maura, did you ever eat at Maura's Delicatessen when it was?
No, but I'm guessing
it was next to the it's next to the Bonnell Street Gallery.
Okay.
Let me tell you, she makes really good food.
Yeah.
I can't believe we got her. Actually, Aaron got her.
Yeah. So. And so just for people who maybe haven't been to storyknife.org and haven't explored what this is, I think there's 2-week and 4-week residencies. And I think that your application is right up there. I mean, the kinds of questions you were asking on your application was not things like prove to us that you're an established writer, but more like prove to us you have a story to tell, or, you know, they were different kinds of questions. Am I right about that, Dana?
We have followed faithfully. You know, we stand on the shoulders of giants. The people who created Hedgebrook, beginning with Nancy Skinner Nordhoff, the angel of Hedgebrook. And when I applied for Hedgebrook, they wanted a sample of my writing, number one. And number two, they wanted me to tell them why I needed to spend time at a cottage at Hedgebrook. Those are the two main things. And so that's essentially what we are doing as well. It seems like a pretty good footsteps to follow in.
Okay, so you would be taking applications now, I would imagine, then.
No, I don't run Story Knife.
Okay.
Karen runs Story Knife. If you want the details, you got to talk to her.
Okay.
But the application period opens toward the end of the year.
Okay. But you're going to have people in the cabin in June, right?
So
the end of
these people are already, to the end of October.
Okay. Okay.
We're hoping that we'll have enough applications that at some point we can be open year round and people won't be scared to come up and be in Alaska in the dark. We'll see. We'll see how that works out.
Right. I have to tell you, I have an email from a listener, Carol Day, who says, please tell Dana that she changed for the best the way I choose whether to read a book or not. I heard her on a public radio program in which she shared that she chooses a book by doing a one-page read rather than paying any attention to the blurbs, and that she said thank you for that because it's changed the way she reads books. What haven't we talked about that you would like to squeeze in here? I'm thinking certainly send people to Story Knife writers.
StoryKnife.org.
Yeah, StoryKnife.org. That's where the application is and all the details that we're fuzzy on right here.
And lots of pictures, too. There's a photo gallery so people can go look at what the place looks like.
Yeah.
We're not asking people to stay in, like dry cabins or anything like that. There's flush toilets and hot and cold running water and all that good stuff.
I noticed when you had your little videos, you always showed there's a toilet here, a real toilet.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, when you ask people to come to Alaska, we have a writer coming from the Philippines, or we did last year. I hope she manages, because we just rolled over the authors from last year into this year and into next year, because we're going to be operating for 2 months less this year than we thought we were. So you want to tell people who are not from Alaska that they're not going to be living in, the traditional moss roof log cabin. That's not the experience.
No sod houses here. No igloos. Yeah, no, that's great. Let's see, we just have about a minute. I'm just going to say, when you leave us today, you're going right back to your desk and you're going to work like a slave all day on your book?
Probably go to the bathroom first, Kathleen.
Let's be realistic. And, Dana, what do you do for, is your writing, when you're on and you're on a deadline, is it 9 to 5 for you writing, or is it midnight to 7 a.m.? What's it like?
I generally get up at the same time every day, I'm at work by 8 or 9. And if I'm hot on the book, if I'm coming down the track to the end, then I'm up until 1 or 2 in the morning finishing, because at that point I just want to get it out of the house.
Yeah. And is your production cycle roughly one book a year, or maybe sometimes two a year?
Sometimes two a year.
Wow.
Sometimes 2 year, never more than that.
Yeah.
I don't think I could do more than that. I think that would be too much.
Well, Dana, I have to say goodbye, but thank you so much for spending time with us on Hometown Alaska. It was wonderful to hear from you. And I'd like to tell our folks that next Monday is President's Day. It's a federal holiday, and actually Hometown Alaska has the day off. So we'll replace the 10 a.m. broadcast with selected stories celebrating James Baldwin. And then the evening broadcast will have Lift Every Voice, a musical story from sorrow to justice, which is including powerful songs, stories, and interviews with some of today's most acclaimed Black artists and scholars. So find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Will Franklin was our audio engineer today. Thanks for joining us on Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.